Thank you for joining us today. Our goal at the Asia Pacific Wine and Spirit Institute is to promote cultural diversity through wine education. This podcast is for wine enthusiasts, beginners, and anyone who is interested in learning more about wine and those who work in the world of wine and culture. Check out our website, www.abwazi.com, and take one of our 30 online wine and spirit courses available. If you're new to this podcast, please follow the show and subscribe if you enjoyed the content. Welcome to the Abwazi Wine Buzz Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clinton Lee. Today's guest can be best described in a singular word, Titan. Not only is he a writer, educator, consultant, but he is a tour de force in the world of wine, and especially well known for his contributions to the Israeli wine industry. Highly respected, it is a privilege to have this gentleman on our show. His name is Adam Montefiore. Thank you for joining us, Adam.
Dr. Lee, thank you very much. I have to say, it's a great privilege to be on this program with you. I mean, it's very prestigious. It's a place to be seen. And thank you for inviting me.
It's our pleasure indeed, Adam. Now, Adam, your name, Montefiore, it means flower mountain, and it has a very rich heritage. Could you share with us and let others know about your family story?
Of course. The name Montefiore is Italian. It comes from the Ancona coast of Italy. Where there is a couple of villages by the name of Montefiore, and the family presumably took its name from these villages. The family moved to Livorno in Tuscany, which is nice considering I was to work later in wine. And then for economic reasons, they moved to England. And I'm the first of the family to arrive in Israel. And of course, my famous forebear was Sir Moses Montefiore, who really was a titan of the 19th century. He was a forerunner of Zionism and a great supporter of the beginnings of the settlement of Israel. He built the first neighborhood outside the old city walls of Jerusalem, and also was a great encourager for Jews to return to agriculture, which eventually led to planting vines. So it's quite a nice story. And finally, he drank a bottle of wine every day of his life and lived to nearly 101, which was an astonishing age in the 19th century. And he drank port. So I feel somehow this was in my genes.
I think definitely those genes of pioneering flow in your veins, Adam. And do you enjoy port yourself?
I love the region. I think the Douro is what is so beautiful that it's sort of heaven on earth. I do love port, but I don't drink it much, as a lot of people don't these days. But there's lots of new wonderful wines, table wines, coming out of the Douro these days. So do I drink it? I think we have so many more options today. So it's very hard to say you only drink one style of wine when Yes. The world, you know, look how much a wine list has changed over the last 30 years. So there's so much variety in these places, even like Israel making good wine.
That's very true. Absolutely. No, the Douro, it's majestic, it's calm, it's furious, it seeps and oozes with tradition. So I would certainly agree with you there.
Now, absolutely.
Adam, you clearly speak many languages because, you know, the name and then Italy, and you've lived in England, and you mentioned there was a Spanish and Portuguese heritage. Do you speak any of those languages?
Not really. I mean, I really speak mainly two languages badly, which is English and Hebrew. I was a part of the Spanish and Portuguese Jewish community in London. The family came from Italy, but a long time before. I'm really very English-Israeli add-on with a touch of Morocco thrown in. You know, like all Jewish families, they've moved around a lot. We, like every Jewish family, we have a very rich background.
Oh, definitively rich. And I think that you are all the better for it, as we all are, when we amalgamate all the different cultures that we have in our own personal story. Now, how did this wondrous wine adventure begin for you, Adam?
Well, I began in the beer industry. I joined a company called Bass Charrington, which was then the biggest brewer in England. And they had the most pubs, and then they became one of the biggest hoteliers in the world. And they also had wine interests. They owned Hedges and Butler, which was a 300-year-old wine and spirit shipper. They owned Chateau Lascon from Margaux. They owned Alexis Lachine, bought from the famous Alex Lachine. And gradually I moved from the beer interest to wine. And while in England, I became wine manager of their hotel division. And that was a transfer fully into the wine business, where I've been ever since.
That is certainly a journey. And, you know, your experience has given you and cut into your character many different facets, vital areas that anyone wanting to excel in the wine industry should have exposure to them. Now, you're very well respected, Adam, and you're known for your pioneering firsts in the wine industry in Israel. For example, the Yarden Award for wine service. Would you share with us and the other firsts that you're most proud of and the significance relating to the Israeli wine industry?
Well, I was very proud while I was still in England. I was a founder member of the Academy of Wine Service and honorary member, which was started, there were many, success has many fathers, but I was one of the people that supported it from the beginning. I came to Israel. I organized the first sommelier wine service course. I ran the first Yarden Award for Wine Service, which was a wine waiter competition, which I also used to run in England in the hotel chain. I realized how good a competition was for education. And I'll give you an example. When I was in England, there was a young wine waiter who took part in the competition. And after I left for Israel, and he went out in the first round. And after I went to Israel, I found out that he won the event the year after I left. So that to me is classic. It was gave him the inspiration and the incentive to study and learn. And from being knocked out in the first round, he eventually turned out to be a winner. So I realized in wine education, a wine waiter competition, explaining and teaching and inspiring was very important. And that was the Yarden Award for Wine Service, which is still the main wine waiter competition in Israel. I formed Handcrafted Wines of Israel, which was 10 small, what we call in Israel, boutique wineries, but in France, we would say small wineries or garagistes. And this was the first time Brand Israel was sold together under one hat. And we had some pretty good wineries. We had Castel and Margalit and Sorah and Flam and Yatir. And these are some of the top wineries today. So that was a good example to Israeli wineries of the benefit of working together. I formed a wine culture center. We called it Wine and Culture, which was like a fusion between wine tourism and wine education, which was pretty unique. I've always been interested in doing things differently if I could. For instance, we made a whiskey at Bruichladdich, which was aged in kosher wine casks, and this was the first kosher wine cask finish of a whiskey. So I've always had my little babies and my little interests, which I'm quite happy to do. And now, of course, it's quite common, but then it was the first. So I enjoy trying to innovate and trying to think out of the box and have my own pet babies, and some work and some don't. And at the end of the day, I'm part of a juggernaut. So it's a real pleasure to play part in the development of Israeli wine, which was still a minnow. But there's been a lot of development over the last 20, 30 years.
Oh, yes. It's starting to begin to soar like an eagle. I remember talking about that whiskey. I once had to give a whiskey tasting to a group of Jewish people. And I had to call up the New York City rabbi from one of the synagogues and ask him about kosher whiskey. So that was a huge learning experience for me.
It's very complicated. Anytime you talk religion, it's very complicated, very hard to explain. And there's a lot of belief involved. So the people that believe in it, belief helps them get over the hurdles. And for the rest of us, we respect anyone who has a wish for kosher wine or wine made in a certain way. And because it doesn't affect quality, the winemaking is the same. The grapes are the same. The winemakers studied in the same place. The fermentation is the same. The aging is the same. The bottling is the same. So a bad kosher wine is a bad wine. It's not bad because it's kosher. You can have a great wine that's kosher. Once you get over that hurdle, you realize that the world is your oyster.
Yes.
To use a bad phrase, because oyster's not kosher, but never mind.
But I think the appropriate and word that you used was respect.
We
just give respect to that. Now, Adam, definitely. What has been the significance for you personally to become the ambassador of Israeli wines?
Well, I'm not an official ambassador. I've become an ambassador by default. Yes. Because I found myself presenting Israeli wine so often abroad, because I'm an English speaker, and because I came from the English wine trade, I found myself almost as a sort of spokesman and became involved in all sorts of ways. For instance, I done the rankings or the pages for Israel in the Hugh Johnson Pocket Wine Book for over 25 years now. And I write the English section, the Israeli section and the kosher section in the Oxford Wine Companion of Jancis Robinson.
Yes,
I've become sort of by default a prominent ambassador, but we don't have the ambassador. But I've been as prominent as anyone, and I consider it a real privilege to be at the forefront or the crest of the wave of Israeli wine. You know, we have we know how small we are, and we're not going to be France or Italy tomorrow. But when you look where we were 20 years ago and where we might be in another 20 years, it's very exciting. And the world is getting bigger in terms of wine. And therefore, the more exotic, unknown, unusual countries certainly create a lot of interest. So it's great to be part of that. So I consider myself like the English voice of Israeli wine. That's what I've been called. And I'm an ambassador amongst many good ambassadors trying to make the case for Israeli wine.
I think not only English, but certainly on the international scale and platform, Adam. And it's acknowledged that you are the cornerstone. So clearly you're very humble, but you are definitely the cornerstone of protruding and pushing forward and advancing Israeli wine. Now, you mentioned, age. Looking back to the last 20 years in the wine industry in Israel, how would you describe the progress to date in terms of the number of wineries, the quality issues, and the economic barriers to entry for Israeli wine?
It's a kind of miracle. I mean, I came to Israel in 1989. Then I think there were 12 wineries and probably one commercial winery, which had 75% of the market, which was Carmel, the historic winery of Israel. And now we have 350, and that doesn't include all the garagists and domestic wineries making wine at home, and there's some good wines amongst those too. The quality has improved no end. The variety of winemakers who have studied abroad all over the world. I mean, once we just had winemakers go to UC Davis, now they go to every wine school there is on the map, winemaking school all over the world, from Australia to Montpellier to Davis to wherever. And then they come back to Israel as young, dynamic, knowledgeable, wine-making force, each one with his own image that he's trying to create, or own aspiration. And so we're a melting pot of people that have studied all over the world. And it's a very dynamic, youth-led, knowledgeable market. And we've gone through a few stages in Israeli wine. Firstly, we started making good wine, which was after 5,000 years of trying, it was about time. So we started making good wine that won awards. We had a winery, the Golan Heights Winery, Yarden Wines, started winning awards, and people thought, oh, Israel can make good wines. Then we went through the varietal stage when everyone was making varietals, and we had big Cabernets and Oaky Chardonnays, and started making Israeli varietals. Now we're getting more to blends from regions. So we're getting more regional. Now, one of the most fascinating things about Israel is we're a very small country, but we're long and thin. And like long and thin countries like Chile and Italy, we have enormous microclimates. So we have a harvest that lasts from mid-July to the end of October. And sometimes on the Golan Heights, it can go to the first week of November. That's a very long harvest. We have a lot of variety. The south of the country is desert, total desert. And if you fly down to Eilat from Tel Aviv and you look out the window, you'll find a little square of green amongst the desert, and someone's planting a vineyard. So it's moving, to see it. It's amazing to see it. Israelis making the desert bloom with vineyards. So we're, and yet you're on the Golan Heights, you've got a snow-covered mountain where you can go on a ski slope. So it's a country of a lot of variety, and we make a lot of different wines as a result.
Right. Now, what about barriers to entry in terms of markets? Is everyone receptive to Israeli wines?
Well, let's be honest. We have we sometimes have political problems. We sometimes have kosher problems. People think kosher wine is sweet or sweet oxidized sugar water, but of course, the kosher wine has got nothing to do with sacramental wine. Sacramental wine, it's like altar or communion wine, is to normal wine. It's a different product. Mm-hmm. So sacramental wine is kosher, but it's not a table wine. So we make quality table wines, and sometimes there is a reputation that people in America think Israeli wines are like Manischewitz, or in England they think it's like Palwin, which are the equivalent sort of wines. So the kosher problem, the political problem sometimes rears its head, even though most people feel that making wine is a very peaceful, productive, product. More people would plant vineyards and make wine and drink less coffee in our region, it would be a far more simple, peaceful place. So the main problem is that Israel is tiny. I mean, we'd fit into New Jersey. We make less wine than Gallo of Sonoma. And that means that we don't have the quantity and therefore the price to sell brand Israel in the supermarkets or in the mass market. So whereas Chile, South Africa, Argentina, Australia all came in and attacked first in England and then the rest of the world, they attacked the mass market and built a brand. Israel can never do that because we don't have enough wine and we don't have the low enough prices. But that can also be a good thing. It means we're not going to have an image for cut price quality. You know, some people might say that Chile has a problem because they're so well known for good value wines that to rise up again is difficult. Where Israel starting high, a bit like New Zealand, and we have to, our main market has to be wine shops and wine restaurants. We haven't got the volume to really attract attention and to, for a advertising program in the mass market. So we have to be smart and realize where we are.
So one is competing with the shield and the sword of quality.
We're trying to, and also being different. Yes. Because wine, you know, we've passed the varietal revolution in the New World, and now people have gone back to talking place again. So people are interested in wines from the Negev, desert, wines from the Galilee, where Jesus made wine, turned water into wine, wines from the Jerusalem hills or the Judean hills on the way to Jerusalem. And each one of these is totally different. You know, the description of the soil, the altitude, everything is different. And they're producing wines of different character. And listen, if you have a wine list and you put in the wines of the Eastern Mediterranean, and you have an Assyrtiko from Santorini, and you have a Chateau Moussa from Lebanon, and a Rhone-style blend from Israel, and you add that to your wine list or your wine shop shelf, suddenly you've got something a lot more interesting, because you might have something that the next restaurant doesn't have. And the Eastern Mediterranean is, of course, the wine region that gave wine culture to the world. And 2,000 years ago, everyone knew what wine from Cyprus and Greece and Canaan or the Israelites or the Phoenicians, mm-hmm. what wine from the same area that's making wine today was quite familiar to people in ancient times, where wine in France and Italy hadn't been heard of. So we do have this long history. We're part of the ancient world, not the old world or the new world. There's been an absolute turnaround in throughout the region, from Greece to Cyprus, even they're making wine in Syria, Lebanon, Turkey. And so it's a fascinating region. And we are part of this. This is our region. This is where we should be on the wine shelves and on the wine lists. And we're part of a mosaic, which is part of the history of Israeli wine. And for the wine world, it's quite an exotic region, because a lot of the people are discovering the Eastern Mediterranean wines for the first time.
Oh, yes. I would fall into that category. Although many years ago, the first time I saw Israeli wine, really? So I truly appreciate the spectrum of wines that are coming from the ancient world. And, you know, which brings me to the next question, Adam. We've spoken about the last 20 years. What do you foresee as the major hurdles for the next 20 years for the Israeli wine industry and its competitive edge on the global arena?
I think the next decade is the decade of finding our identity. You know, previously people learned to make good wines, but there were blends from all different sorts of regions. Now wineries are looking more to make single vineyard wines, wines from a single area, or to identify certain plots in the vineyard. So we're making wines with more identity, more a sense of place now than ever before. Global warming is a challenge to everyone in the wine industry. I don't think people give it enough thought, even though everyone's suddenly talking sustainability and with the fires and the floods, and everyone knows what global warming is now. But Israel is probably the southernmost wine country producing quality wines. That's why to make wine, we climb. And even in the desert, Israeli vineyards, which were founded by Rothschild in the 19th century in the coastal plain, mm-hmm. have now moved eastwards and northwards in search of high altitude. So we have a lot of vineyards more than 500 meters above sea level, going up to sort of 1,200 meters. And even the vineyards in the desert, which I've talked about,
yes.
are very high altitude, 800 meters above sea level. And for that, it mitigates against the latitude and you get a cooler climate and a longer growing season. But global warming is a big aspect. I think Israel is in a sense, still has to be discovered. I mean, I've been into a restaurant in Boston with a sommelier, with a great Tastavan, and I asked for Israeli wines. And he turned to me and said, "Do you mean Manischewitz?" And this is someone who's trained in wine. So I realized suddenly Manischewitz is the main symbol of the antichrist or the anti-kosher quality wine, because it's the most simple type of sacramental wine, well known everywhere in America. Mm-hmm. And so it makes me understand we've got a lot of work to do. And even though I've been working with this all my life, we've got to continue, and the next generation have got to continue. So Israel still has to be discovered. I think we have to find our voice. We have to find our identity. We have to keep doing quality, and we have to keep making wine at every price point. And this includes the larger wineries in the relative mass market that they can get to, like Barkan, Carmel, the Golan Heights Winery, Tabor, Tepperberg. They have to also concentrate on the quality for value and the cheaper range too. So I think if we work together and we concentrate on tastings, to bring awareness of Israeli wine, to show the variety of wines of the Eastern Mediterranean, because I believe Eastern Mediterranean is very much, Mediterranean cuisine is very much in. Israel cuisine and Israel chefs are conquering the world with their brashness and innovation and chutzpah. And the Israeli wine is part of that. And we're part of an amazing region of history. And the one thing we have in common is that once we were all under the Ottoman Empire, not so long ago. So this is our roots in this region. And then, of course, we go back to Bible times. But I feel for the wine lover, it's a fascinating wine region. It's like a new world.
Yes.
In the oldest, one of the oldest wine producing regions in the world. So that's the paradox.
Yeah, it's as you said, discovery. Now,
yes.
Talking about discovery, many wine consumers don't initially sort of rush to select or even think of Israeli wines when deciding, you know, upon a bottle of wine. What advice would you like to share with the wine consumer out there about the uniqueness and quality of Israeli wines?
Well, I think, again, Israel represents the place. And if you're Christian, it's the Holy Land. You can buy wines from Jerusalem and the Galilee. If you're Jewish, we make the best quality and the biggest variety of kosher wines in the world. And I'm not ashamed of the kosher word. The kosher word is something that adds value to the label, like having vegan or sustainable on the back label. Mm. It's a form of perfectionism, a form of checks, like a ISO checklist. So I don't knock kosher at all. I think, and for the Jewish wine drinker, it's essential. So the Christians can drink wine from the Holy Land. The Jews can drink the best kosher wines in the world and the biggest variety of kosher wines in the world. For the sommelier or the wine store, right. looking for something a bit exotic, something a bit different, something to set them apart from the neighbor down the road, then wines from the Eastern Mediterranean and Israel is an option. Now, 30 years ago, or 35 years ago, as wine manager of a hotel chain, I first understood that Israel on its own was too small and too, against the giant countries, it was too insignificant. But if you put us as part of an Eastern Mediterranean section, and you add in Greece and Lebanon and Israel, and you choose, look at the variety, the history of the wine, then the quality of the wines in this area,
certainly.
And you look at the changes that are happening in Turkey and Cyprus, you realize that for the wine sommelier or the wine geek, this is fascinating. I mean, you and I are the type of people, we don't drink Chateau Lafite every night. And if you see something that you haven't tasted on a wine list, you have to try it. Oh. And Israel's in that category.
So we're never going to be
the next California, but we can offer interest, an exotic quality, and a new wine region. And wines are now a sense of place. The Eastern Mediterranean, the place to give wine culture to the world, a new wine world in the oldest wine growing region. I know these are slogans I've used, where the quality has changed. We have indigenous varieties. We have enormous variety of production, and we fit very well into the mosaic of our region. And to me, it's the most interesting and dynamic wine region in the world today, the Eastern Mediterranean. If you look in the last 20 years, what's happened, there's no wine region that's changed as much as the Eastern Mediterranean. And so I think for every person who loves wine, who wants to taste something new, that is paradoxically old, and introduce yourself to a whole new world.
Certainly.
So I think we're interested, we should be interesting to the wine geek, to the sommelier, to the wine store owner wanting something different, or simply wanting to cover a wine region that hasn't been on the wine list before. Maybe Chateau Moussard was on the wine list. So let's add to it. And 30 years ago, when I was wine manager of this hotel chain, that's what I did. I put Yarden wines with Chateau Moussard under the heading Eastern Mediterranean.
Right.
And I realized it was far easier to market the two wineries together as a story rather than each one under Lebanon and Israel on its own.
That's
and from since that day, I've been a fervent advocate of the, and even a pioneer of marketing the Eastern Mediterranean.
Well, I'm sure we're going to see more and more of an expansive range of wines coming from the Eastern Mediterranean. Now, Adam, you mentioned, Israel has its own varieties. Now, when we think of Riesling, oh, Germany comes to mind. New Zealand, oh, that's going to be Sauvignon Blanc. Now, what would you think, or is there already a current signature grape for Israel?
Unfortunately, or maybe it's fortunately, there isn't, because even though we've been making wine for 5,000 years, we're 20 years into a really quality wine production. And Israelis are great at experimenting. So you tell an Israeli he can't plant wines in the Negev, he goes and plants wine in the Negev desert. You say this variety won't grow, he'll plant it to show that he can. So we have a lot of varieties here. There are a few standouts if you're looking for something associated with Israel. I mean, our biggest planted variety is today Cabernet Sauvignon, like everywhere else.
Right.
The inherited or adopted variety is, I suppose, Carignan, which has been here for 150 years. It was planted in the 1880s or even 1870s. As a workhorse grape. And now we have some old vines and people are making beautiful old vine Carignans. So this is like our adopted variety. It's almost become, it's not Israeli, but it's become, you know, it's just been in Israel as long as Malbec has been in Argentina, for instance. Then we have other varieties which just seem to be very well suited to our climate, like Petite Syrah, or Dreif, like Marcelin, which is new in the last 10 years, but proving very good here. We have, you know, that probably the most suited variety to the Eastern Mediterranean, in my opinion, is Syrah or Shiraz, which is great variety for the high altitude limestone soils, stony soils, hot climate of our Eastern Mediterranean region. And it seems to do well in every country as well as Israel. Grenache is growing well here. Petit Verdot. I'm drinking a Petit Verdot now, by the way, just by chance. Petit Verdot is a variety that you, as a great expert on Bordeaux, will know. Petit Verdot in the past, in the far past, often didn't ripen in Bordeaux. Now, of course, there's a problem with that. But in Israel, there's no problem with ripening. Nice. So it's a variety that has almost replaced Merlot in the quality Bordeaux blend as the second highest percentage in a blend with a lot of wines. And this is a Petit Verdot varietal. So Petit Verdot is a variety that grows very well here. What will be the future Israeli variety? I don't think there'll be a variety. I think Israel will be known for blends. We're a very southern latitude country. And like the southern Rhone, Israel is now excelling in innovative blends, either of Mediterranean varieties or Bordeaux varieties mixed with Mediterranean varieties. And I feel that we're going to be a country known for the regions, the Golan Heights, the Galilee, the coastal plain, the Judean Hills, the Negev, as opposed to particularly one variety or another. We do have an Israeli red variety called Argaman, which is a cross between Sauzo, the Portuguese variety, and Carignan, which can make very nice wines. Peppery, it's a red with good acidity, refreshing acidity, nice fruit. And then we have what we call the Holy Land indigenous varieties, which have been here forever, which people are just experimenting, you know, like they're doing in every country.
Yes.
They're also doing in Israel. So we have varieties like Marwawi, Hamdani, Jandali, Tabuki. Oh. They all sound Arabic, and that's, of course, they were survived during the time of the Ottoman Empire. A lot were planted in the Hebron area by Palestinian-owned vineyards. And now there's a lot of research into making wine for these varieties. So there's lots of interesting things happening. But one variety out of all of those, you know, if you asked a lot of people, people might say, Petit Verdot, Carignan, or Petit Syrah. I think we'll be known as a country of blends. And I think it's suitable to our place on the map. South of a certain level, of a certain latitude, blends seem to be more popular than varietals. Those, I've mentioned the main varietals that you'll talk about when you talk about Israel.
Yeah, and there seems to be a sort of vast array of shelves, you know, full of varieties that many people have not even heard of, let alone tasted. So that's something one can look forward to. Now, you know, Adam, you and I, we know we've tasted an enormous volume of wines over our career. And this brings us to the point of reviews. Now, recently, as you know, there was an article where there was a statement that said that supposedly reputable publications, one that claimed to be independent, suffer from numerous conflicts of interest. And it was stated that as a result of this, this has meant faith in wine reviews have been eroded. And this was written by Lisa Peretti Brown in an article of Meininger's Wine Business International. Now, so there's that aspect. And we know that there are other reviewers who review 25,000 wines a year, which is an enormous number. I mean, I don't know how many tongues one must have in order to review that. But you know, the public do rely on that. Well, what, it's a staggering amount. I mean, what are your thoughts and insights on the value of wine reviews in today's world?
Well, I'm a bit schizophrenic. I insist these days that I'm a wine writer and not a wine critic. I don't give scores. I refuse to give scores. Mm-hmm. For for intellectual honesty, if I taste a wine now, this Yarden Petit Verdot, I know that in an hour's time or half an hour's time or after I've eaten or whatever, it will be totally different. So when do you give the score? And how can you say it's honest score when you, you know, most scores are giving in a tasting, as you know, you have a what we call in Israeli slang, a schluck, and the, you know, a sniff and a taste, and then you go on to the next wine and you give a score. So I think it's, I think, as I don't want to be a wine critic like that. I consider myself a wine writer, I tell a story, and I refuse to score wines, even though a lot of people have approached me and said, we need an Israeli to replace Daniel Rogoff, who is the critic, our famous wine critic, who died in 2011. But I don't want to give a score. I don't give a score to a restaurant. I don't give a score to opera. I don't give a score to a concert. So it seems inappropriate to give a score to an art form, especially one that's changing in the glass. And I can't honestly say that this wine is, you know, my two children are in the wine business. And we get together on the Sabbath evening, which is Friday night.
Yes.
And we often taste wines together. And they're my best partners to taste wine with. And we're all, they've also been in the wine business a long time now. And how many times we've been made fools of? We buy a special wine, we open it, we expect it to show something. And it's disappointing.
Yes.
And then we go back an hour later or 2 hours later and suddenly our eyes light up and hearts lifted and it's a fantastic wine. So we fall into the same trap. So that sort of experience, which surprises me again and again, encourages me to think that wine criticism, it's a luxury for people with a lot of confidence to do it, that they can say this is a 90 wine and this is an 89 wine. I don't have the brashness to do that. However, I'm schizophrenic as a winery, and I spent most of my, we haven't talked about it, but I spent most of my life working for wineries. For 27 years working for Israeli wineries. When I was with a winery, I was the first to make a noise if we got a good score from Robert Parker or if we won a competition gold medal or a trophy. I was the first to do it.
Right.
And I understand that consumers like it. So I realize one side that it's important not to take these competitions too seriously. Secondly, as a winery, I always said, don't get too excited if you win. It's not such a big deal. And don't get too disappointed if you lose. And I realize it's part of the sort of new Parkerization hijacked by the Americans, taken on worldwide, this 100 score. And we're stuck with it up to a point. And it helps people, you know, if they can look at a score instead of reading a tasting note. And most tasting notes written commercially, you know, you can read a flowery tasting note and you get nothing out of the wine. You know, it's beautiful, you know, it's the beautiful fruit basket of tastes in the wine. But if you can try and compare it with the next wine, it turns out to be very similar. So there has to be a balance between the score and the tasting note. I'm very cynical of these people that taste so many wines. I realize it's important. And there is a different level of respect. I mean, I once worked for a winery where we got a gold medal in a competition when we didn't send a wine. And that's true. I won't embarrass anyone by saying which competition it was, but it really happened. And obviously there's a difference in the quality or the respect you give that wine competition with Decanter World Wine Awards, for example.
Right.
Where there's serious people tasting. And so, and there's a big difference between Chances Robinson, who won Reeds and who's a goddess and really defies, you know, she's a pearl that's lasted so long in the business with a certain honesty and a correctness which you can follow.
Yes.
And of course, wine criticism is not a horizontal tasting. You can't compare scores across different critics. You have to pick, you know, you can't say this 90 against this 93 against this 95. You can only do it vertically with the same critic. So if you choose your critic that you like and you follow that critic, then I suppose it's okay because you're comparing like with like.
Like with like, yes.
And the last thing that I want to say is that wine criticism is a business. Competitions are a business. Someone's making money. So you have to take it all with a pinch of salt. And wine criticism is a very fine line between what is okay and bribery. Very fine line. I mean, you're entertained for lunch by a winery, or you're sent a bottle at home, or you know, there's not very strict rules. So that the critic that goes out to really show that he's impartial, as Robert Parker did when he began, should be respected. But overall, to summarize, I don't like points myself. I realize consumers like it. I realize wineries love it, and that's why they exist. I don't take them too seriously. And people tasting that amount of wine, this week we had the Sommelier Wine Exhibition in Israel. And there were some wine writers going around with little pads, writing everything down, and looking very professional. And I felt after I'd tasted a certain number of wines, all the wines started tasting the same.
Yes, yes.
Not the time, not the place to do a tasting. So everyone does their own thing, but I think it's very hard to taste a lot of wines. And it's very hard to do it, to taste that amount of wines in a day. I know that people like Robert Park and Jancis Robinson can do it because I've seen them do it, and they're amazing. But I can't. I mean, I lose concentration after a certain time. So I respect those with the image that do it and provide something which reveals something to help us, the minnows, understand something. But as a concept, I don't have a lot of respect. And as a writer, I certainly don't believe in scoring wines. I don't think it's something that I feel is right at all.
So I would say, as us mere mortals, we shall leave it to the gods and goddesses to tackle that issue.
And of course, the reason it succeeds is because there is a market for it.
Yes.
And I explained, as a winery guy, I was the first to say, oh, we got a good score, and to publish it. So that's why the system works, because it's important for the wineries, it's important for the consumers. I've seen consumers going around a supermarket with a book open, checking the scores to see, people use them. And so it's there and people can use them if they want or not. But I'm pretty cynical about it.
Now, Adam, my last question to you. You've shared with us some of the experiences, not all, and I wish we could spend more time. But I know that many of us would like to know, if you had the choice of a perfect, if one does exist, but the perfect meal with the perfect wine pairing for you, perhaps there could be two or three options. What would they be?
Wow. Firstly, I'm a bit of a Philistine. I've always...
Hardly, sir.
No, but when I write, I write for a newspaper, not for a wine magazine. And I'm known for trying to take the pretentiousness and snobism out of wine. So I frequently write, drink what you like, it doesn't matter. It will go with the food.
Yes.
And I have to say, throughout my career, I've drunk the wine that I want with the food that I want. And I've never had a problem. So I think that matching food and wine is a sort of something we do for fun. But in practice, I think most people buy the wine they want, and if we want Something Made in Heaven, which is very personal to me, a good right British Stilton and a nice vintage port, to me is a match made in heaven. And if ever you want to show someone that wine with food can be 1 and 1 equals 3, that's a very good place to start. And Stilton, of course, is my British roots, where I was until I was 32. So, nice. You know, famous blue cheese. Yes. And port is, you know, what the Brits drank a lot in the time gone by. So I think that's a pretty good example of wines. In Israel, Israeli cuisine is an enormous variety of small dishes, spice and different little canapes and you know, what they call the meze, which is the Eastern Mediterranean, and something that goes very well with those, which is a wine that people, which is sort of pretty lost in Israel, doesn't appear much, is Fino Sherry, which I think is a wonderful product, which goes well. I think that what's quite fun is tasting different wines and being surprised that something goes with it. But I tend not to make a cathedral of wine pairing, which I used to when I was younger, and I used to be involved in wine service in the hotel and running the wine competition. Of course, matching wine to food was something that I did all the time because I thought it was part of the enjoyment. Now I realize that it's almost a bar to the general customer enjoying, because it builds up this smokescreen of knowledge. You know, if you ask them, what do you think of the wine? They will say to you, I don't really know about wine, which they never do with food. And the reason they do that is because of us, because we've been educating them that wine has a certain language and a certain knowledge, and you have to be able to talk the game to partake of it, which is a pity. So in my early life, I was very enjoyed building up this being part of this club and discussing wine, matching wine with sauces and herbs and spices or the prominent ingredient of a dish. Now I've suddenly realized it doesn't really matter. Uncork a bottle and enjoy it. And if it's the wine you want, it's okay. No one's going to say, oh, it was a terrible match to this food, unless it's, you know, smoked fish and tannic red or something.
Right.
But so I'm far more relaxed about creating an ivory tower of excellence in matching. I think now it's more important, just open a bottle and enjoy it. And take it for what it is and learn about it. But don't feel you have to have a certain knowledge before you can partake in this game. So this is slightly, you know, I've got to a different angle these days, where I try to take pretension out and get people to relax. You know, it's just fermented grape juice. Enjoy it.
Adam Montefiore, it's been an immense pleasure having this interview with you. And there's one word I would say is mazel tov.
You've been listening to Wine Buzz Podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please leave a review or share it with a friend. Apwazi is an online wine and spirit institution dedicated to promoting culture and diversity through the world of education. If you're looking to get started, we have a free online course that we are giving out to all our listeners. For more information, head to apwazi.com. That's APWASI.com.